Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Truth and Movies. Today, Charlize Theron returns to the Jason Reitman Diablo Cody cinematic universe for the parental dramedy Tully.
You're like a book of fun facts for unpopular fourth graders.
And anime newcomers Studio Ponoc go toe-to-toe with Studio Ghibli in the magical animated treat Mary and the Witch's Flower.
Tonight, I really am a witch.
And for Film Club, it's a fan favourite, a listener recommendation. It's Jonathan Demme's Something Wild.
Our accountant would sure wonder what I was doing in a cheap motel in the middle of Jersey on a Friday afternoon.
All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, it's Michael Leader here, sitting in for AC Jimbo, sitting across from head honcho of Little White Lies, David Jenkins. Hello, David.
Hi there.
And Manuel Lazic. Manuel, welcome. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good.
So first, a bit of follow-up from last week on The Avengers from Liam...
What's that? I've never heard of that.
It's a little movie that came out last week. Did you not see it, you think?
No, it's a movie that has all the actors.
Neither of us have seen it, actually.
No.
And actually, speaking of acting, Manuela, you wrote a piece about acting in the age of the blockbuster.
Yeah, I wrote a piece, so obviously I have not seen the movie, but it's a piece about the superhero genre today, so it's not really about that specific movie. And it was about how those films, because they are ensemble movies and because they are superhero movies and because they are very expensive and they make a lot of money, they end up swallowing up all the talent we have, especially in Hollywood. And my piece was kind of criticizing that.
And that's
you can find it on the website.
LittleWhiteLies.com. But Liam Murtagh, after the, I think, solid fours and fives across the board from the crew last week, he went to see it. I was all set to send my children to see Avengers Infinity War whilst my wife and I went to see A Quiet Place. However, these plans changed after listening to your rave review. Such was your praise for this superhero epic that we changed plans so all of us went to see Infinity War. Well, Infinity was well named, as the film went on forever, and to what end? In the film, Doctor Strange has seen 14 million future scenarios, and couldn't he have seen one that, after a 10-year chain of superhero films, had a plot that unfolded over the course of a single film? If you can't tell a story of the beginning, middle and end over the course of 2 hours 40 minutes, you don't deserve to be making films. I could have seen A Quiet Place twice over. I should have seen A Quiet Place twice over. That I didn't even see it once is your fault. Well, we have editor David Jenkins here to answer.
Guilty as charged.
Well, should we offer a full refund? And no, I mean, you know, as with all cinema, you know, you take your chances. You know, I think that's the whole magic of it, is that you go in and you don't know what you're going to get. And some things are going to be too long and unwieldy. And I mean, I feel for a film like Avengers Infinity War, there was enough info out there about it and possibly alternative conflicting viewpoints and takes on the film where you could have maybe, you know, it would have been possible to build a bigger picture of what it is you're going to go and see. But
it's always a risk.
It is always a risk. It is always a risk. And, you know, like, I don't know if you've seen A Quiet Place yet, but you could end up going and hating it and feeling you've wasted 90 minutes because that's the game, baby.
Yeah, I know people who have, so, you know.
I was exactly the same. A Quiet Place became this word of mouth hit. And I went along on a Wednesday evening, actually the same week I saw Tully, and was very underwhelmed, really, by it.
Whereas I wasn't overwhelmed.
Yeah. Whereas Avengers, after having almost a 50-50 hit rate with the Marvel Cinematic Universe to date, I loved it. I really did. I was more invested than ever.
I tend to go for the little kind of side project films over the big kind of central core films, like the Avengers ones being the absolute pits for me. Like the first Avengers film I found unwatchable. Like so bad. But like that's personal preference always. But
well, Liam, you're not alone with your view there, and hopefully we'll fare better this week with our films. Speaking of which, we're going to start with Tully, which is the third collaboration between director Jason Reitman and writer Diablo Cody after Juno and Young Adult, the latter of which also starred Charlize Theron. And we have a clip to listen to.
You seem like a great mom.
Great moms organize class parties and casino night. They bake cupcakes that look like minions. All the things I'm just too tired to do. Honestly, even getting dressed just feels exhausting. I open my closet and I just think, didn't I just do this?
Yeah, but that's the downside of living on a planet with a short solar day. Although Jupiter's even shorter.
You're like a book of fun facts for unpopular fourth graders.
So that was Charlize Theron as Marlowe, a mum of three, who's overwhelmed by the daily parental grind. That is until Mackenzie Davis, Tully of the title, comes into her life, a manic pixie dream nanny who whisks away all of her problems. Manuela, so set this one up for us. How does this fit into the Theron, Cody, Reitman annex?
So I found it to be very much a follow-up to Young Adult, in that Young Adult was about this woman who's trying to return to who she was when she was younger and full of hope. And this one is kind of the same because it's this mother of three who's struggling with her life as a very busy mom. And she's kind of full of regrets, even though she's not really admitting it. So in that sense, it does fit into it. But I found Tully to be much less successful than Young Adult. I'm a huge Young Adult fan. Mm-hmm. When I watched it, I was completely surprised because I'm not a fan of Jason Reitman. But I found Tully to be just not quite successful. And I would say it comes more from the script by Diablo Cody than from Reitman himself. I think Reitman does some really beautiful sequences of, showing how being a mother is difficult, but also showing how it's a lot of tenderness towards your kids and how all those two things are in the balance at all times. And his use of music is really nice. There's a really fun sequence when Marlowe goes to New York one night, and it's really refreshing and really fun and respectful, because I find that sometimes Jason Reitman is a bit too cynical, because this film is very cynical and Young Adult was as well. But I think on the script level, I think the sort of mystery it sets up is not successful at all. And you can kind of predict it from the start. And even if you don't, when you find out what is going on, it's not fun. It's not exciting. And it feels just really wrapped up very fast at the end.
And that's where it does depart a bit from Juno and Young Adult, which are almost flips of the same coin in terms of it's Diablo Cody's very spiky, observational, but slightly heightened and stylized dialogue.
Yeah.
But they're both character pieces about a certain stage in life. Yeah. Whereas this one does have this sense of mystery, which we can't go into for fear of spoilers, but even if you see the trailer, there's this other shoe that you're waiting to drop about this strange, almost supernatural figure that comes into her life that's Mackenzie Davis.
Whoa there. Yeah. Whoa, close.
But it's a bit like it touches on, you know, fantasy a lot more, which could work. You know, it's like I have no problem with sort of magical realism and stuff like that in like fantasy world. But I don't think the film reconciles that, you know, gritty reality of being a mom with her, you know, like the fantasy aspect. I'm not going to say anything more because I know I'm like on a very fine line here. But yeah, but I think Charlize Theron is amazing. I'm a huge fan and I think she's always delivering the goods. And again, she's doing that thing where, you know, she knows she's gorgeous, but she's going against that. Mm-hmm. So there's a moment when she's sitting at the table with her kids and her youngest son drops a glass of water on her. And so she's so tired that she literally just takes her T-shirt off and she's in her bra. And, you know, she's not skinny at all because she's
and
just had a child.
The daughter says, why do you look like that, Mommy?
Yeah, she says, what happened to your body? and it's very... Yeah, like I admire her willingness to go there. And, you know, she's still beautiful, obviously, but, you know, she's willing to admit that she's getting older.
Yeah. How did this land with you, David?
Sorry to be like Davey Downer again, but I'm not a massive Jason Reitman follower or lover. I find his films very cynical and they're very kind of, he has this kind of thing about introducing us a person or a character who is maybe superficially unlikable and then sort of desperately trying to show why we should empathize with them or like them for something maybe bad that they're doing. One of my kind of lowlights of my film watching career in the 21st century was the film Up in the Air, which I think is a, a monstrous film. But yeah, this one I found quite interesting for like maybe 20 minutes at the beginning, because it starts off as a portrait, a character portrait, and he's basically showing you the process of what it's like to have a third child and be, you know, in a sort of lower income bracket as well, and feel a little bit like disappointed with what you've achieved in your life. And it's just very simple, you know, just showing what happens, what interactions are like, what it means to be staying up at night, what it means to change nappies over and over again, what it's like to have a sort of slightly passive, neglectful spouse, and just dealing with it, you know. And then something happens and the film pivots at that point to become something slightly different. And it just lost me then. It all seemed very kind of contrived and silly, and you kind of feel that something's up. It just reveals that it's not this kind of honest, sincere film that's interested in the mundane things that people have to do to get through their lives. It's actually quite cynical and negative about them. It's actually, these are really boring things. Let's remember the exciting times. And it feels like it's very kind of critical of being poor. It's very critical of having to deal with children and bring children up, and sort of the sex lives of poor people. It's another sort of Diablo Cody, Jason Reitman, you know.
There's such a tension at the heart of this film, both on a screenplay level and the way it's been, you know, directed. There's, as you say, this very simple observational goal of showing life as it is, the mundanities and so on, but then this cynicism in all directions. You talk about how there's this cynicism about poor people and your lot in life and realising in your 40s that this is the path you've gone down. But then the characterisation of the people who have got it good is, I think, quite clunkily cynical
it
as
is,
well.
It is very ridiculous. It's like you visit their house. It is the most kind of obvious and like shoddy kind of characterizations of like they've got iPods everywhere and they've got like, you know, they're feeding their kids sushi and you know they're always talking about a new piano. Yeah. And it's all just like, what's the most obvious depiction of like nouveau riche Americans that we could create? And it's just rubbing salt in the wound.
Well, the line that one of those characters utters is during this nouveau riche dinner party, they shout into the phone, "Siri, play hip hop."
Which is
almost just this sort of damning characterization. They don't even know what they want to listen to. They're going for a genre.
It's interesting. I really thought it was going to, you know, go around on that, because that rich guy is Marlo's brother. And I thought, you know, he's trying to help her. So I thought maybe eventually the film would, you know, kind of make a comment on how, sure, like money makes a difference, but also if you're a good person, you can be like, I thought it was going to be much more progressive than that, but it just isn't. It sets up this dynamic and it tries to make the character of a brother, played really well by Marc Duplass, as kind of this a bit more complex guy than he seems, but turns out that no one cares about this. Like in the end, when everything is solved, he's not there. Like, it doesn't matter. And it's such a disappointment.
And I do think that Charlize Theron and Mackenzie Davis do work together on screen quite well, even if sometimes the situations become more contrived as they go on. And I almost thought there's a central sequence of the film where it almost is Diablo Cody's version of Noah Baumbach's While We're Young, where there's this middle-aged sort of former Gen Xer just staring agog at this together millennial who seems to have it all figured out, have all the perspectives, just be a natural earth mother as well. But then it doesn't really go in that direction, doesn't really go in any of these directions that it sets up.
I think the film is much more interested in its sort of narrative twist thing than in the actual topics it's exploring on the way. Like, it doesn't really care about the money aspect. It doesn't really care about the motherhood thing. Like, it uses difficult maternity as a trope in a very icky way. I think this film has already been criticized by parents as being incredibly irresponsible about the way it depicts certain parents' reactions to having kids. Like, it's using it as such a fun, cynical trope when it's a very serious matter, like having kids. And throughout the film, I liked the first 20 minutes, as you were saying, because I was constantly on edge. And I think that was on purpose, because I was scared that, you know, something would happen to the babies or something.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But then the film doesn't earn that ever. It's very uncomfortable.
It's true. It could just be more boring. You know, like yeah. It, being more boring could also mean that it's more like empathetic.
Yeah,
you know? And
yeah.
it's more kind of humane.
It just felt like an awkward halfway house for me between an observational
yeah.
kitchen sink almost drama versus something that could have been more heightened and stylized in different hands. Mm. Really,
I think, for instance, Diablo Cody's Jennifer's Body
yeah.
succeeds so well at being like a fantasy thing while still being, you know, saying interesting real things about, you know, being a teenager and things like that. But it's so much more successful because it's so much more unapologetic and bold.
Yeah. Shall we give some scores to this then, Manuel?
Sure. I mean, Anticipation, I was really excited for it. I would say 4 because I really loved Young Adult. Enjoyment, no, I would say 2. It really drags as well. It's only 1 hour 36, but it feels long. Mm. And in retrospect, yeah, 2. I'm really disappointed.
Davey.
I was probably saying I was a little less anticipation. I remember not loving Young Adult, but in my memory of it is actually probably it felt a bit subversive, that film. Like it was doing some quite interesting things and going to some interesting places where I think this film doesn't do that. So I'm probably going to say like 2 or 3 for Anticipation. Maybe 2 because I just don't really like Jason Reitman at all.
Oh, gosh.
For that first 20 minutes, it's probably going to get a mark. So 2 and 2. 2's across the board for me on this one.
Well, personally, I loved Young Adult, really, one of my favourite films of that year. Mm-hmm. Although since then, Reitman has made Labour Day and Men, Women and Children real missteps of films. So probably Anticipation 3. I'd say Enjoyment 3. It's a short film, at least. And then probably Fading in Memory in retrospect, but then also the turns it takes that don't really pay off. So, yeah, 3-3-2.
Sally could also be called Men, Women and Children.
It could.
Yes.
He could turn it into a series, Men, Women, Children.
I think any film could be called Men, Women, Women, Children. And maybe
Avengers
it should.
Avengers Infinity War? Well, Men, yeah. Men, Women, and Children.
I'm not sure if the next film we're talking about could be called Men, Women, Children. It's more Girl, Cat and Broomstick.
Yes. So we'll, nice link.
Exactly. So we're now going from Tully to Mary and the Witch's Flower.
Come on, Peter, let's go.
Mary, stop. Everyone knows you're not supposed to go into the woods on misty days.
I found it in the woods.
The witch's flower. They only bloom once every 7 years. They say witches used to seek it out.
What is going on? Tonight, I really am a witch.
Mary and the Witch's Flower. This is a Japanese animated film from a new studio called Studio Ponoc, adapting a kid's fantasy novel, The Little Broomstick, by Mary Stewart. It's about a young girl who one day ventures into the woods and finds a broomstick and a magical flower that grants her powers and whisks her away to a school of wizardry. David, how should we look at this film? It's from a new studio, but they're all pros. What do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. It feels like a kind of transitional film in the sort of Japanese anime world, or I guess that kind of post-Studio Ghibli output, which is now going to be, I guess, coming a bit more regularly. Yeah, this is by the director of who did films for Ghibli, Studio Ghibli, Arrietty, and When Marnie Was There. And it feels very much of a piece with those films. Mm-hmm. It's about a young female protagonist and her kind of adventures in a kind of slightly fantasy world.
It's definitely set in the UK. It's one of those strange, heightened and fantastical versions of the UK that you get from those Japanese films.
It has that kind of love of kind of Anglophile culture, European culture. Ruby Barnhill, who does the voice of the lead actor, has quite a thick accent, and it's kind of lovely to hear that. And you've got Kate Winslet as well as the kind of baddie.
And Andy Serkis' son.
Andy Serkis'
well.
Son.
It plays Peter.
And Jim Broadbent as well. So they're all doing very kind of thick English accents, and it works really well. So yeah, it's about this little girl, and she ventures out into the woods, and she's a bit bored on her summer holidays, and she finds this flower and picks it, and next thing she knows, this old broomstick that she finds springs to life and transports her into a kind of nearby netherworld. Can you have a nearby netherworld? I think you can. It's a sort of like weird alternative reality that is like an entirely new galaxy that is actually only a few minutes by broom from her little kind of cottage. And it turns out to be a kind of in the sky academy for upstart witches. Of a very kind of Harry Potter.
Very Harry Potter.
It's a very, very kind of female spin on Harry Potter, although it uses animation in an interesting way to actually, you know, it's far more kind of eccentric and has sort of like these surreal splotches throughout of, mm-hmm. you know, monster design and various kind of bits and bobs. Like much of Studio Ghibli, it has a kind of eco theme as well, because one of the discoveries that happens is, involves the sort of animal population. And I had an enjoyable time watching this film. Mm. I wouldn't say it's probably up there with any of the Studio Ghibli films quite. It's maybe got a bit of refining to do. Mm. I think the thing that I love about Ghibli films is they sometimes take quite small stories and give them this sense of epic scale. Mm-hmm. Even a film like My Neighbor Totoro, which is like, you know, one of my all-time favorites. It's this tiny, tiny tale. Like, you know, nothing happens. It's a girl who runs off and is found again. But it somehow manages to bring in the weight of the world and a real sense of, like, life or death. Mm-hmm. Whereas this film, I don't think, manages to do that. It was quite slight in the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly slight. And I have to be very careful because I'm so deep in this world of anime that I can very easily go way too deep for our conversation purposes. But over the years, for almost 20 years now, the animation industry over there has been searching for the next Miyazaki. And every time a new film comes out or a new filmmaker comes to term, they're saying, is he going to be the new Miyazaki? Mm-hmm. And Hirohisa Yonobayashi, who's been around at Studio Ghibli, you know, for probably 15 years before 2014, when they closed down, when both of their main, you know, their main heads retired, they shot out on their own and made this company. And what's astounding about this film, and what almost stops me from being able to view it objectively as a film, is that it's almost a greatest hits package of everything that you expect from a Studio Ghibli film, made from not only one of the directors of those movies, but nearly all of their animation staff was poached from the offices of Studio Ghibli once they turfed them all out, sent them on their merry way.
It absolutely does feel like a kind of, we know we're taking this new route now. We know, mm-hmm. you know, we don't want it to look like we're kind of against you. Mm-hmm. So we're going to make this kind of grand homage for the fans. You know, it's, you know, absolutely, there's like references to pretty much every single Ghibli film.
Rewatching this film yesterday, there are specific sequences at the very beginning where Mary is waking up and looking out her window, messing with her hair in the mirror. It's exactly the same as the beginning of Kiki's Delivery Service, which is the sort of little witch hits out on her own Studio Ghibli film from the late 80s. And then also Howl's Moving Castle and Spirited Away and so on. It's all represented in this film in a very homage, montage kind of way, without really finding its own identity. The animation, I think, is top-notch compared to nearly all of its competitors, you know, its peers mm-hmm. today, in Japan at least. However, it doesn't have that wisdom that Miyazaki had, that easy wisdom of storytelling, sewing together themes, or showing children in extraordinary circumstances finding their own way. It's not quite there in this one, really.
There's a sort of sequence right at the beginning of the film where a witch is being chased away by these kind of weird flying monsters mm-hmm. that when you see them, you instantly would link them to the world of Studio Ghibli, like the shape and the way they fly and the sounds they make. And you do feel straight away, right, I'm back in that world. Mm-hmm. But it never quite does anything with them beyond, they feel more kind of, you know, pictorial, superficial. They're mm-hmm. just that they're there as part of the background rather than like integral to a story, which I think one of the things that Miyazaki managed to do was actually kind of tangle all these things together. They weren't just kind of bits over here and bits over here and these over here, you know, it wasn't just like for show. Everything had a meaning, I think.
Yeah. What it reminds me of actually is it's almost like when the Star Wars films were taken on by a new generation and wrested from George Lucas, who was a guy bringing in all of these influences into his own vision, which is what Miyazaki did. He makes Japanese animation but is drawing from quite obscure English language children's books and experiences wandering around Wales or Northern Europe, and it forms this style that's completely his own. And now you have a generation that's just copying that or homaging that, and it's a funny film.
From what you've said just now, it sounds like a Ready Player One, but for Studio Ghibli. Like, it's full of references yeah. that people will like, but it doesn't really understand them at a deep level, or it doesn't use them to their fullest potential. But I haven't seen it, so it's just my...
I wouldn't have instantly grabbed for that, but it totally makes sense. Yeah, I mean, you know what? I wouldn't say that the references in this film come in the same way as they do in Ready Player One.
Mm-hmm. They're not
in,
as like,
in quote marks with like capital letters. They're a bit more kind of like woven into the fabric of the film. I'd probably give it a 4, just because anything that's associated with this world, I'm just excited to see and I love, and probably 3s for enjoyment and in retrospect, because I had a nice time with it, but there was a nagging sense of wanting more, and I think it is that kind of. The legacy of Ghibli has set the bar so, you know, insanely high that it's going to be hard to watch these films now and take them on their own terms and value them for what they're doing themselves rather than how they're comparing to the greats. So, and for that reason, I'm probably not going to be running back to it. No. You know,
for me, my anticipation could be higher for something like this. Of course, I'm going to be there. Not only because I've followed this filmmaker throughout his Ghibli career, but also any animation that's getting this size of release, my seat is guaranteed. So 5 in anticipation. It was a dazzling film. I went on a journey with it on a level of animation. So 4 enjoyment. But I agree with you. I'm not going to rush back to see this. So probably 3 in retrospect. And that was Mary and the Witch's Flower. Would you go out and see that, Manuela, do you think? You're an animation fan?
I like animation. I'm not very knowledgeable of it, but it sounds sweet, so I might.
I mean, it might be something for those who aren't familiar with the Ghibli canon. It could be a nice little kind of, you know, gateway drug, you know. Yeah.
But those films are all also in cinemas up and down the country all the time, or they're on Blu-ray and DVD or on TV. So it's one of those situations where do you want to go and see Ready Player One, or should you go and watch an 80s movie?
Right? The answer is...
Ready Player One is the Rosetta Stone for all film criticism now.
Basically.
And speaking of 80s movies, we're going to go back to the 80s for Film Club for a Jonathan Demme special for something.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Wild. So Something Wild, as we said earlier, this was something of a fan favourite, one that we've had many requests for, including Yeroen Hoban. He wrote in once he heard saying, "Yeehaw! I'm so excited you followed through on my film club suggestion for this week. Something Wild is my Demi darling, and it's one of my all-time favourite road movies. Daniels, Jeff Daniels, is so perfect in this, as is Melanie Griffith. Forget about the plot, their chemistry alone is enough to keep me in my seat. Not to mention Ray Liotta in his first big movie role here as the perfect villain. His unpredictability and mean spirit actually reminded me a little of Dennis Hopper's Frank Booth in Blue Velvet." The reason I got into Demi's films is because Paul Thomas Anderson kept going on about him in his interviews, and I can definitely see what he took from his mentor. Both filmmakers have taken on many different genres and styles, and you never really know where they're going to go next. That spontaneous feeling also applies to their stories, which unfold in ways you can't predict. And we're going to listen to a clip where one of the stories is unfolding in an unpredictable way, where we have Jeff Daniels and Melanie Griffith trying to book a room in a motel.
Something wrong, Charlie?
Maybe it's not such a good idea, you know, getting a room. I mean, don't you have some place we could go?
How about your place?
I can just see the neighbors watching you get out of the car.
You have money? I mean for the room. The rest is free.
Let me check. I only got these, these credit cards, which are, company plastic. Our accountant would sure wonder what I was doing in a cheap motel in the middle of Jersey on a Friday afternoon.
Here's the cash.
I can't use that.
Why?
That's money for the Christmas club.
Charlie, are you telling me that we're not going to get a room because you're saving money for Christmas presents in the middle of June?
So something wild. I must admit, I'm a bit of a demi-debutante. I've seen some of his 90s movies, Silence of the Lambs and so on, and his concert movies, most recently, his last film, the Justin Timberlake straight-to-Netflix film. But Davey, are you something of a demi-expert?
I think I've still got some spots to fill on my sort of demi-auteur rewatch schedule.
Me too.
There was a couple that I caught recently, which I absolutely loved. I think that currently on Netflix is the film Married to the Mob, with Michelle Pfeiffer.
Which followed this one, I think.
Yeah, and it's really funny. Really, mm-hmm. really funny, with Matthew Modine as well, who is a kind of an actor deserving of more attention, especially in his kind of comedy roles.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess I know the classics pretty well. I mean, I'm a big fan of Rachel Getting Married as well, of his more kind of later ones, and obviously the Stop Making Sense, which is the Talking Heads film. And this film feels very much of a part of that era.
Mm-hmm.
It's a film that we have had lots of people just requesting, and
Is it a favourite of yours, Manuela?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was lucky to catch a screening of it organised by the Badlands Collective, I think a couple of years ago maybe. I didn't know anything about it. I knew it was a demi picture, and I knew it had my favourite Jeff Daniels in it, and it's absolutely just so charming. And it's, I think the title Something Wild is so perfect because it is so wild. Like even if you explain the plot, it doesn't even make sense. It's very, very crazy. And it's very much a demi picture because it is so much about, it has a lot of music, but it's kind of about music in the sense that it's so free and spirited, and it really goes like a song that you like and you don't even know how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really so special. And I think what that person online said is very true. It's not even about the story. It's much more about the chemistry.
Yeah.
And it really is about just these two characters, so Charles Driggs, played by Jeff Daniels, and Audrey Hankel, played by Melanie Griffith, having just a crazy chemistry.
Yeah.
And just following on that they don't know anything about each other, and they just follow through on this.
But it sort of starts
crazy.
Almost like the Scorsese film After Hours. It's this collision of the yuppie world where Jeff Daniels is this guy in a suit and tie and then meets this free-spirited kind of, you expect her to be a sort of downtown art woman. She's got a Louise Brooks hair, the black bob.
And she's reading a Frida Kahlo book, a book about her.
And she whisks him off on a wild weekend that sort of turns into a road movie, turns into a rom-com, turns into a crime movie, a thriller. It's hard to pin down, isn't it?
It is. I mean, the thing I love about Jonathan Demme's films, and, it's hard to sort of say something that covers him, entirely, but there is a sort of, freeness to the way he makes movies, where you're kind of, not just in the sort of plots or the characters, but just, the way he shoots the landscape and the way that the camera will catch a detail off to the side, or the way he uses kind of extras in the background to really give a sense of a place or a time, and the way then he combines that with music as well. There's a real sense that he's kind of, he's not just making a movie, but he's actually trying to kind of capture an image in his head. And I think this film really is about that, just him looking at America as much as it is this kind of mad dash across country.
That's so true. And I think that's, rewatching that film yesterday, I really realized how much Paul Thomas Anderson was inspired by Jonathan Demme, because he kind of does the same thing of being at the same time very free, and at the same time he knows exactly what he's doing. Because I think he's free in the sense, with his camera, in the sense that if something looks great, he's going to shoot it that way that he wants that it will look the best, even if it doesn't really cohere with the rest of the film, because he's just in the moment at every time. And I think Paul Thomas Anderson does that a lot. That's how he manages to catch the sense of place so well, because he knows that a place has a lot of things going on. There's like the people doing weird things in the background. There's people singing. There's, people... At some point, Jeff Daniels is waiting by a phone booth, and some guy arrives on a bike, and he has a dog with him, or with a little helmet. And it doesn't go anywhere, but he's just true to the reality of the situation, because that happens in real life.
So many unexpected moments. There's another bit where there's an establishing shot outside of a house and just a car full of kids drives past blaring New Order out the stereo. It doesn't go anywhere. You expect the camera to follow them or something, but it's just a little moment.
One little moment that I love is when Ray Liotta steals a car and there's like loads of toys in the car that he has to sort of like throw to the side, and it's just such a lovely kind of lived in detail that kind of, you know, is sort of part of, I think, how Jonathan Demme thinks about taking these very process elements of a film. A guy gets into a car and steals it and just makes it into something human. So I kind of love the film without loving it. Like, it's so kind of taking kind of generic ideas of like the rom-com and the thriller and the crime and fusing them together in a way that I find quite kind of, you know, I think it's trying to sort of repel you a bit. And the sort of tonal shift from very buoyant, almost sort of slapstick screwball to this really quite nasty,
very nasty
finale, like within the stretch of a single film, experiencing those two poles, I find quite discomforting and difficult. I find it interesting more than I find it enjoyable.
I'm the same. It goes all the way through to the look and feel and sound of the film as well. It has this wonderful like mid 80s sort of anything goes postmodern pop art approach to the soundtrack, the costumes, everything. It's all kind of pretty garish to look at from, you know, 21st century eyes. But the soundtrack in particular, where you have David Byrne during his sort of world music phase, you have Laurie Anderson and John Cale doing the soundtrack, a very synthy kind of score, but then also reggae and early hip-hop and everything goes. And then the Feelies, who are a sort of almost post-punk, almost no-wavy kind of jangle band, appearing, playing a four-song set at one point. It's, you know, everything smushed together, and it's as amazing, as you say, look into a filmmaker's worldview and into their head, but also a bit kind of disorientating.
That's why I like it, though. Like, I know it sounds typical of me to say that, but I like how it goes from one extreme to the other, because I think the film is called Something Wild because it's kind of about the character of Jeff Daniels trying to find his wild side without going crazy, like the Ray Liotta character, who's just evil. Like, he reminds me of Bob in Twin Peaks. That's how scary he is. So it's all about managing to stay in reality, but also, you know, punching up like towards like more dreamlike things, but make them real in your real life. So that's why, you know, that's why he likes to sometimes run out of a restaurant without paying, because he likes the thrill of it. And that's safe. He's not harming anyone. And I think that's why the film has those extremes of, you know, slapstick and then kind of horror movie. Basically, that some moments are shot like a horror movie, because I think it's trying to present how it's difficult to live a dream, like to live in your fantasy. You can't, because reality is there always and it's going to drag you down. But that doesn't mean you can't keep trying. So sometimes you will, you know, get your nose hurt, but that's okay. You can still go for it.
I find it fascinating that this is pretty much the same time as Blue Velvet coming out, because they're
that makes so much sense.
They're both criticisms of the breakdown of the American dream, but almost one is this nightmarish view and one is this kaleidoscopic dream view of it all.
Yeah, optimistic.
It's maybe worth mentioning as well that at the BFI at the moment, there is an entire season of films under the banner of Lost in America, and it's a kind of look at the cinema of the Reagan era, but this kind of lost generation of kind of detached teens and people who fell out of the kind of Reaganomics dream, you know, of which, you know, Something Wild is playing. I think he's getting a couple of screenings sort of mid to late month. So, you know, other films in the season. In fact, Michael and I went on a little date last night to see the opener of the season, this extraordinary film called Out of the Blue, directed by Dennis Hopper, about a trucker who causes a terrible accident, and the film sort of charts his life after that and the life of his daughter, and it's kind of how the punk movement tips over into the 80s. One of the other classics, which one of you guys might have seen, that I'm really excited to, is River's Edge.
I've not seen
Keanu
it.
Keanu Reeves.
I haven't seen many of the films in this season. There's also Suburbia, the Penelope Spheris film. And also Lost in America, the film itself,
Albert Brooks
in a big Winnebago.
I'm really keen to see a film called Crossing Delancey by Joan McClin Silver, who is a kind of a much touted female director of the 80s, who also made another amazing film called Chilly Scenes of Winter. Really apropos considering what we're talking about here.
Indeed.
So
yeah, that runs throughout May at the BFI South Bank down in London, if you're within the catchment area. I think we've filled in our opinions on Something Wild quite well, but should we read out a few more of the listeners' comments?
Absolutely. We should, yes.
Because I think we got some pretty good uppercase exclamation mark filled responses here.
Yes.
Do you want to go first, Davey?
I'll read this letter by Astro Wiz. Something Wild is probably my favourite Jonathan Demme film. It's really marvellous. I remember watching it for the first time several years ago and how surprising I found it. How the tone and pace of the movie shifted in a rewarding way, and I couldn't second guess how the story was going to unfold. I think I made the mistake of watching the trailer before watching the film for the first time, and it really doesn't convey the movie very well at all.
Another reply to this film being talked here is from Josh Slater-Williams, who is a contributor to Little Well Eyes. He said, perhaps the most perfect blend of Demi's penchant for humanism, seamless mood shifts, killer soundtracks and cameos by cult figures and musicians. And I couldn't agree more.
And one here from Luna Carmoon. I'm looking forward to the bleep here. Sue Tissue, killer costumes, soundtrack queen, Griffith, and her many looks, say no more, heart emoji.
Yep.
We got quite a few emojis for this one. We got some, how do you describe
that?
It's like, you know.
It's the okay sign, right?
It's the okay sign twice. Yeah. So double okay this film.
From Laura Hernando saying, love this film, the fashion, also ace soundtrack, and two okay signs.
That is terrific. So Something Wild. Is there anything else we want to mention this week, Davey?
Yeah, I want to do a quick shout out to a film I really don't want to see kind of fly under the radar. It's called The Dreamed Path by a director called Angela Shalanek, who is currently receiving a bit of a kind of retrospective on MUBI at the moment. She's been making films for 15, 20 years now. And this one has kind of like raised its head above the parapet. She's mainly been confined to the festival circuit, but this one is really worth catching. It's going to be screening at the Genesis Cinema on the 10th of May. And it's just this kind of very idiosyncratic, weird film where this couple are together at the beginning of the film. They're busking in Greece and something happens, which means their lives kind of split apart. And it just does really interesting things with time and space and storytelling and focus on what matters and what doesn't when you're telling a story. And it's quite a kind of technical film in that sense. And it's very challenging, but well worth seeking out if you can. And also, can I just say this one other thing and then I'll pass over to you? Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm hogging.
It's all right.
I'm hogging. This is big news, I guess. As of Tuesday, the 8th of May, your regular dose of Truth and Movies is going to be chopped up and spread out like some delicious French pâté, yes, on a crisp bread. All three of us, and including Adam Woodward and Sophie Monks-Kaufman and Elena Lazic, we're all going to be heading over to the Cannes Film Festival to report from there. And we've decided that instead of one big weekly dose, we're going to be giving you lots of little doses of Truth and Movies. And we're just going to be telling you what we're seeing, and we wanted to use the opportunity to tell you, listeners, about what you should be looking out for in the future, what we see, what we like, what we don't like.
And that's pretty much for the next fortnight, really.
Indeed.
This little change.
Listen in, and we're going to be trying to read out as much reader correspondence as possible and feedback, so let us know what you think.
So, yeah, you can send us stuff to truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, and there's LW Lies on Twitter. There is no film club this week because of that, but any Can tips or can comments should come through and we can read them out while we're there. But Manuela, I guess, is Can what's in your future, what you're excited about?
Yes,
as well.
It is indeed. I'm going to be there the whole time as well. It's going to be the best. It's
my what's your second film that you're most looking forward to?
The one film I'm most looking forward to in Can. One film I'm excited to see in Can, although he's a bad person, is the Lars von Trier movie, The House That Jack Built, because it does seem interesting. It's about a serial killer, and it's with Matt Dillon, which is interesting. So I'm excited for that. I hope Lars won't say anything stupid, but that's not my problem. I'm here to watch the movie, so yeah.
Do you have one film, Davey? It's an interesting year.
Yeah, it is an interesting year. It's
a weird year.
Yeah, it's a strange year. And I think it's kind of, the idea is it's a sort of rebirth year. But I've got to say another one that I'm looking forward to is a more mainstream one. It's a new Spike Lee film called Black Klansman with Adam Driver in. And yeah, I'm excited for that one. Yeah. I like Spike Lee.
And I'm going to stick to form, and I'm excited about the anime film called Mirai from Mamoru Hosoda, who did, well, Summer Wars and The Girl Who Leapt Through Time. That's premiering in Director's Fortnight, and it's unique and groundbreaking because it's the first anime film to ever have its world premiere in Cannes.
Oh, wow.
So we'll see how that goes. It's a sort of wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey family drama. So we'll see how that goes.
It's going to be such an interesting year because so many that I expected to be there are not there. Like, I wanted mm-hmm. Brian De Palma to be there. I wanted Claire Denis to be there, and they're not. So, yeah, but it's going to be interesting.
Leaves it open for surprises.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be a festival of discovery. And yeah. So, you know, hopefully our podcast will reflect that.
Yes.
We shall see. So thank you for joining me today, David Jenkins, Manuel Lazic.
Thank you for having me.
I've been Michael Leader, and this has been Truth and Movies, a 7 Digital production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.